The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 91.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I really enjoy talking to. He's one of my favorite Aussies, and that is saying a lot. His name is Martin North, and he is with DFA Analysts. Martin, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, George. Great to see you again.
All right. So like we were saying prior to hitting the record button, there is a lot going on right now. I mean, we've got protests in the United States, rioting, looting. I guess some of this has filtered down into Australia as well. I really want to talk to you about the Aussie housing market. But before I do, kind of what are your overall macro thoughts that you've been mulling over the last few days?
Well, I guess I've got three. The first is, what on earth is the market doing? I mean, yep. The market's, you know, the 500 is back now to where it was before all of this thing happened, right?
As though NASDAQ suddenly magic highs.
Yeah. You know, as though it's all over. And to my mind, I can't see how it is all over, because all of the economic data that I'm looking at says this is going to be a long, slow grind. So this is not a V, maybe a U, maybe a W. I mean, what letter should we throw at it, right? the second is, what are some of the social consequences of the riot? Because I think this is more than just, Black Lives Matter, critical though that is. I think this is a broader signal about people's frustration with, you know, how politicians run things or don't run things, right? And thirdly, I still come back to this. If we think that the coronavirus is the worst thing that could happen to us, to my mind, this is a signal that we should be listening to in the context of, you know, the climate change adjustments that we're going to have to make, like it or not. Otherwise, the whole planet's going to basically burn in the next 50, 100 years. So in a way, we almost seem to be, fiddling while Rome burns, but the big questions just aren't being addressed.
And what are those big questions in your mind?
Well, the big question to my mind is, if we are really going to want to have a planet that's habitable, then we've got to think differently about our economic drivers. We saw when the lockdowns were in force, what difference there was to the climate, you know, less smogs, less pollution, those sorts of things. If we really want to have a planet that's habitable 100 years from today, we're going to have an industry basis driven differently from where it is today. We're going to have an innovation platform that's different from the ones we're running with today. And those big political questions will require international cooperation, a complete different economic model than the one we've got today. And yet we seem to be muffing it, you know, we just can't get there. So it almost like, you know, you could see a glimpse of what the future might look like, good and bad. But no, we're just going to focus on the immediate short term and, you know, think about the next election and those things. So there's a longer context for all the stuff that's going on at the moment that I think we're missing.
Yeah, and there's a lot to unpack there. So if someone can say, all right, Martin, well, yes, the air quality has dramatically improved with everyone staying at home, but it's at the cost of the economy just being crippled. So I think someone that was very pro oil, and we don't need to really dive into that on this video, but someone would say, listen, Martin, you know, if we just get off of oil right now, that's what's going to happen to the economy, because oil is has such a higher level of energy density. So how do we get from oil to a cleaner energy without suffering this massive economic decline that the coronavirus has proven will be a result of a lower economic output, I guess?
And that's the critical question. I mean, I don't have all the answers, but what we do know is if we continue down that track, you know, we had the bushfires here in Australia over the summer, right? The worst bushfires in probably 100 years. We had, nearly three quarters of the population exposed to bushfire smoke not just for the odd day, but for weeks and weeks and weeks, right? That was a sort of a bit of a signal that, you know, things will not be able to continue the way we are. And yeah, I agree, oil is absolutely a foundational component in the way the economy works at the moment. But we have to be thinking about transitioning, right? And it's going to take a long time to be able to make those transitions. And it's going to take a lot of innovation and a lot of creativity to be able to build an economy on a different basis. But we, you know, just saying, oh, it's, you know, it's going to damage the economy too much is not an option, because otherwise, you know, eventually the planet's not going to be habitable. And, you know, whilst the expedition to Mars might actually offer an exit for a very few number of people, this is the one planet that we've got. And I keep saying to people, you know, we're using about 2.5 times worth of the assets, right? And we've only got one planet. So that ain't going to work.
Where do you think nuclear fits in there?
Well, I'm actually of the view that there is a place for it. And, you know, I know that there's been a lot of issues with regards to, you know, the pollution and the disasters and things. But the new generation of, you know, nuclear, small nuclear, looked to me to be quite interesting. You know, not having these massive single units, but actually, you know, a different model. I mean, you know, there are issues with it, but there are issues with all energy sources. What I can say in Australia is, with our sunlight and, you know, with our massive continent, we should be right at the front, you know, thinking about using sunlight and other sustainable sources of energy and wind and things. Now, I know there's issues with it because, you know, it's not always there and you have to be able to actually have, you know, sustainable supply, all those things. But, you know, this is what the technology conversation should be. You know, is it nuclear? You know, what we've come out in Australia is no, the answer is going to be gas, right? So we're basically going to use gas as a sort of an interim measure. But of course, gas still makes emissions. It's not quite so emission intensive as coal. And there are people in Australia who still want to build more coal mines and basically export more coal. And there's a market for it still, because, you know, there are countries around the world still building coal power stations. I understand why, you know, because it's probably the cheapest, most accessible form of energy. And of course, with oil prices really low, then another reason for cheap energy. But all I'm saying is, I think there's a vision question here about, you know, taking a longer term view and trying to begin to lay a path for the future. We got a glimpse of, you know, the way that the economy works and the way that the environment works. And it was a bit of a wake-up call for me, certainly.
Yeah. And then what makes it even more complex is each country is in its own stage of development. So it's, you know, it's easier for, not that it's easy anywhere, but it's easier for an Australia or a United States to make some efforts to transition than it would be for Ecuador or Colombia or, you know, some place that's much more developing. It's definitely a challenging question, but I think if people can come to the table and actually talk about it without getting emotional, it would be a lot better for all of us in the long run. But it goes back to what Thomas Sowell, my favorite economist, always says, that there's no solutions, there are only alternatives.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good point. You know, there is no silver bullet here, but actually just denying that, you know, this is going on and this is an issue that needs to be thought about and talked about, it is probably the biggest mistake that we can make as a species, because it could be actually a species killing it ultimately.
Yeah. And the problem is, it's just like the political environment right now in the United States. You just can't talk about it with people unless without people getting emotional. And then you just throw facts and data, it all just goes out the window. And people just, because it's become so politicized, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like people, they get so tribal, especially right now in the United States with either you're for Trump or you're against Trump. And if you're for Trump, you have to have this belief system. And if you don't, I'm not even going to talk to you. And if you're against him, you have to have this belief system. And there's absolutely no critical thought whatsoever.
No, I agree. And look, I'm a philosopher by actual background, right? And so I try to ask the question behind the question behind the question, right?
Yeah.
And essentially what I see all the time is people just taking that first question, but not actually really unpacking it and understanding what the real issue is, right? And so you become polarized. You know, I'm for climate change, I'm against. It becomes a religion, actually.
Yeah,
more than
totally.
Anything else. And in the process, rational thought and rational argument and rational strategic thinking about the future, right, just goes out the window. And then, of course, you get the political cycle. So everybody's worried about the 3 years or the 5 years or whatever, you know, the 4 years, whatever the political time is. And people are only interested in getting to that next election and winning the next election, rather than actually taking a more strategic view of where we need to go as a species. And I just think sometimes, you know, we need wake up calls, and we need things to actually cause us to stop and think. And like I say, I think COVID potentially could be a trigger for, you know, if we're sensible, just asking the harder question. But unfortunately, at the moment, that's completely, you know, the whole climate change discussion and how to adapt and evolve and change off the agenda. Nobody wants to talk about it.
I've spent a lot of time in Ecuador, and I've got some people that work for me right now from Venezuela. So I've obviously tried to kind of pick their brains. Is it, you know, what is it really like there? And trying to understand how an economy can work well and how it can not work well. And one of the things they did in Ecuador that they did in Venezuela, which I think was one of the big catalysts to the problems they've had there, is they subsidized the cost of fuel. So I can't remember the exact numbers because I haven't been back to Ecuador for a while. But as an example, let's say a gallon of gas, they subsidize it so it's 25 cents a gallon. And so the government is losing a massive amount of money just by getting it out of the ground and giving it to the people in society. Now, of course, the argument is, well, that's great for growth because it's all about fuel and transportation and energy costs and keep that low. But then my counter argument is, okay, well, you're building an entire economy around something that is totally unsustainable. And we found out in Venezuela that when you put all your eggs in one basket and that those eggs go bad, you got big problems.
Yeah. Well, you know, the three quick data points to sort of start this part of the conversation. The first is we have more than 1 million spare properties across Australia now, right? We have a population.
But to put that in perspective, what's the population?
25 million.
Oh, wow. Jeez.
Okay, 1 million, right? Secondly, migration, which was around 350,000 at the peak, right, has come right back because of COVID. So we don't have foreign demand, right? So,
right.
And we have 1 million of our working population. Let's say, I don't know, the working population's what, 10 million, something like that. I don't know, give or take, maybe slightly more than that. 1 million working in the construction sector, right? And then the last data point is, 65% of all bank lending is for property.
Right. So in other words, the money supply, the creation of money. Yeah.
Correct. So basically we have a situation where the politicians know this, that essentially the construction sector is essentially the cornerstone of the economy. It's been that like that for a long, long time, right? Because we've got a very narrow-based economy. You know, we dig a few minerals out of the ground and ship them overseas. We, you know, sell some food internationally. And then we basically build houses, right? Now, my argument is the construction sector is really, really important for the economy, but we should be actually thinking about where we should be building for the longer term rather than just more rabbit hutches, right? Because effectively the quality of the construction is pretty low at the moment. And now basically the latest announcements from both the federal and the state is more subsidies to allow people to be able to go and make extensions on their properties or to buy new properties, or, you know, or first-time buyers to come into the market, as you say, pulling forward demand, right? And of course, this has a significant impact in terms of, you know, the price of houses relative to income, as we discussed last time. It's way off the scale, and most people can't afford it, right? And interestingly, in the since COVID, right, the regulators have dialed back the lending standards, so the banks now can offer interest-only loans to people with existing loans. So, you know, you can convert your loan from a principal interest loan to an interest-only loan and just keep borrowing some more. And by the way, well, you know, if you want to roll that on, that's fine. We'll give you a six-month interest and principal repayment holiday.
Do they do that with cash-out refis to where you can take the equity out of the house, or is that just to buy the house?
it looks to me at the moment, although it's a bit shady, precisely what's going on here. Most people are getting it on existing loans, but there is now starting to be some refinancing. So a lot of the banks are trying to, you know, fight each other for the businesses that is there, right? And they're offering really, really cheap rates to get people across. And some of those, when they are refinancing, are still pulling equity out of the property, right? So the magic money machine, as I call it, right, is, you know, house prices go up, you have a mortgage, right, you sit on that for a little while, you create some equity, then you pull that out and then you buy another property, or you pull it out and buy a car or whatever. So it's that sort of, you know, the circus goes around. Now, here's the really interesting thing, right? Up until quite recently, house prices were looking quite bullish. They'd gone down and then were up again. But now house prices are being to sort of go the other way. And so people are beginning to get a bit, cautious about it. CBA, one of our big lenders, said there is a chance that we could see a 32% price fall over the next couple of years, right? So one of the major lenders, now they're still lending like there's no tomorrow, all right? And whilst they've shaded back their loan to value ratio standards a little, they're still very happy to lend, right? So we've got, think about this, we've got the politicians thinking about, I need to make sure that I try to get jobs. The easiest way to get jobs is, you know, support the jobs market is to support the construction sector. We have a million people, a lot of people need jobs. So you build more houses, right? And then you get the banks to basically lend to be able to fund that house purchase, so households get into more debt. And so we see that the dial moving towards higher and higher debt in the system, right? And this thing goes on and on and on. And I keep saying, at some point, the music's going to have to stop. But the truth is that the politicians are very keen to keep the music going. And I, you know, in my scenarios now, I say there is a scenario where house prices will continue to go higher because they're all doing more unnatural acts, as I call them. They're throwing more money at the system to basically keep. But it's not helping, right? Housing affordability is as adverse as it's been for a long time. There's been very little real income growth for a long, long, long time. And that means that although interest rates have come down and therefore people's ability to service a bigger mortgage is higher than it was, we've come almost to that lower bounds now with terms of interest rates. They can't continue to cut rates, right? Mortgages, you know, I can't see how they go negative despite negative interest rates, which might be interesting thing to talk about. But the fact is, everybody in the political class is essentially backing the construction sector and the construction is housing. And I'm just saying, nah, come on. We need a different plan. We have to find a different way from this point because we are not investing in the things that will actually create long-term longevity for our economy, that will create more momentum. Because in a way, if you think about it, when you lift the loans and you lift the property values, what you're doing is just inflating. You're not actually creating new value, right? And even the prospect of wealth, right? So people suddenly think, oh, my house is worth this, so therefore I'm worth this. No. All you're doing is just lifting both sides of the equation. And so it's illusory. This whole thing is illusory. And yet, you know, it is the fundamental pretext on which the whole of the Australian economy is now based.
Yeah, and it's just such a massive misallocation of resources, and you've got it all funneled into this one thing where they're just being wasted. I mean, you just said there's a million homes unoccupied in Australia. Think of all the commodities, the lumber, the labor, think of all the construction workers that aren't going and being a doctor or aren't being, you know, something else, anything else that would be productive in society because they're going into construction because it might be easier, higher paying job. Then, you know, you're consolidating the revenue stream, for lack of a better word, for the entire economy. And then when that comes crashing down, you have no diversification whatsoever. And, it's like a business just having one customer. And just relying on that one customer. You would think, you know, as a smart business person, you'd say, wait a minute, if that customer goes out of business, I'm screwed. So maybe I better look for other customers and try to build a more stable platform for my income. But it's just, they just keep doubling down.
Well, it's what's interesting. I did an interview a couple of weeks ago with a senator, a liberal senator, so on the conservative side of the house here. Who actually, on camera, on my show, said, this is nuts, right? there are people in the political environment who understand that this is really a silly thing that we're doing, right? But they are actually not in a position to be able to influence the, you know, the people who are making the decisions, right? And what I find fascinating here is that if you talk quietly to politicians, they know this, right? They've known for a long time that this is a one-way street to nowhere, and yet politically, they can't do anything about it. So they almost they express helplessness. They express frustration about, you know, we're not investing in, you know, businesses for the future. We're not investing in innovation. We're not enabling, you know, small businesses to grow and develop. In fact, small businesses are being crushed left, right, and center at the moment, because this juggernaut, you know, which is effectively the finance, housing, politico, you know, complex, those things together are just ruling the roost. And it is the most interesting, I mean, from a philosophical perspective, it's one of the most interesting things that you can look at, because you can see how the source of power, the source of money, source of influence, and the outcomes are all being aligned. But it's not actually for the good of Australians, in my view. I mean, I think we are actually digging a really deep hole for ourselves, because, you know, this is going to actually run out of runway at some point. But you're absolutely right about we're missing the opportunity. If only we'd invested over there rather than over here, we could actually have had a completely different shape to our economy, a much more sustainable, a much more broad economy, right? And, you know, there are some really interesting businesses here in Australia that just cannot get help. I interviewed somebody the other week, I haven't put the show up yet, but I will, who's actually got LED powered streetlights, right? They actually specialize in installing them, and they've got a really interesting business model. They've had terrible trouble essentially getting anybody in authority to understand that this is actually a much cheaper and more effective way of lighting, right? Because it's not actually within the sort of the standard ambit of what people are thinking about. And I hear this all the time from, you know, innovative businesses. We just cannot get this off the ground. Oh, I get cross.
I'm assuming they can't get the financing they need either. They can't get the small business loan because correct. The bank is saying, why on earth would I take a little bit of risk with this business when I could just pile this, create additional loans in real estate and know that I've got a put, for lack of a better word, from the government, and I can create more loans. I make more money with less risk.
Well, that's exactly right. And of course, even the Baal risk ratings, right? So basically, if you lend for housing, right, the amount of capital you have to hold is much lower relative to if you were lending to small businesses, right?
Okay.
So at the very heart of the way that the international banking risk models work, it's actually biased against innovation, against business, and towards finance for housing. So it's a fundamental philosophical problem that we have again, that essentially the whole system is orientated in the wrong direction. You know, that's why banks make rational decisions, because they can use much more, you know, much more capital and get much more leverage. And of course, banking is a leverage business.
Yeah. Do you guys have reserve requirements there?
We do, and we also, you know, there are capital ratios we have to keep.
Yeah.
We don't have to hold money at the central bank like some other places, but there are mechanisms that the central bank has in terms of maintaining liquidity and those sorts of things. So yeah, it's a slightly different model.
This podcast is sponsored by my friends at Capitalist Exploits, one of the few research letters I read myself. If you want more information on how this powerful tool can help you become a better investor, plus get a 15% discount, check out our affiliate link. We'll put it right in the show notes page. What do you think about Richard Warner? And I don't know if you've studied any of his work, but if you have, what do you think of his concept of moving to a model that's much more based around the community and smaller community banks instead of these juggernauts that really only want to pay attention to the big players, and because it's going to take them just as much human resources to do a $3 billion loan as maybe a $3 million loan to the guy that you interviewed that had the LED streetlights. What do you think of his idea of doing that? Do you think that's beneficial? If so, why?
Yeah, so I've always believed that the old argument used to be that you need big banks because the scale of the technology that was required to run a bank was, you know, you need mainframes and, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, that may have been true, right? And they also argued that basically you could get more capital efficient for being big. Those arguments, I think, are now blown out the water because the technology has completely changed. You know, you can run a bank on a server on a, you know, very easily, right?
Yeah.
And what you've missed is the close proximity to the community. And you know, my father was a bank manager, right? And he was the, along with the vicar, you know, he was actually one of the pillars of the local community, right? When he was a bank manager years and years ago, right? And he was horrified when he saw these banks getting bigger and bigger and more distant from the local community. He couldn't make decisions towards the end of his career to support local businesses. He had to go upstairs to be able to actually seek permission to make the loan, right? And he could see this whole thing becoming a marketing, centralized, controlled thing, right? And in the process, he said to me, you know, towards the end of his career, I can't do what I used to do, which was to help the local community. So we have to find a way back to aligning, you know, the local community to the finance that it needs, I think. And so I'm a great supporter of from the ground up, right? You know, community banking and those sorts of things. Now, there are risks that you have to, you know, cope with, and you have to recognize that there are standards that need to be adopted in terms of risk management process and things. But fundamentally, bigger is not better in banking, in my view, these days. And interestingly, you know, if you think about how banking is now delivered, which is predominantly through the internet, right, the distancing between the decision makers and the people who actually need the funds is getting more and more and more distant rather than actually less. I think we're missing a really important point. So I think Rich is onto something.
Yeah, I just go back to my own experience. In 2012, I retired. And if you looked at my personal balance sheet back then, it was incredibly strong from a standpoint of a borrower. And I was buying a lot of homes in the Midwest at that time when they were just pennies. And I was just paying cash for them. And so all the properties I owned, I owned outright. And unbelievably, it was very hard for me to go to a bank and, number one, even get a mortgage to buy a property or to even take out the equity that I had in one of these properties that I owned outright at like a 50% LTV, you know, to buy more property or to do whatever. And so it's weird that, especially when banks get this large, it seems as though they lend when they shouldn't be lending. And then they pull back lending when they actually should, when there's less risk because the market has bottomed out. But my point is, at the beginning, I just couldn't get anybody to give me a loan. And finally, I met a small community bank there. I met the vice president of commercial lending, and we went out for lunch a few times. I told him the problems I was having of getting anyone to even pay attention to me at all. I said, look at my balance sheet. I'm like, look at all these houses I own. Look at the cash. Look at how much money I've made over the past, you know, 10 years or whatever. And he's like, yeah, it's just the environment right now. But he got to know me. He's like, listen, you know, here's the line of credit. Here's whatever you want. I ended up not even really using it to a large degree. But since that time, I've gotten to know him very well. And now whenever I go back to Kansas City, we have dinner, we go to lunch, we grab coffee or whatever. And now I know darn well that if we went into another downturn, that I'd pretty much be able to borrow whatever I wanted to borrow because I've established that relationship. And he's made a lot of money on me in the past because every once in a while I'll use that line of credit or I'll use his bank to for borrowing. But my main point is I was able to build that relationship with him. So now there's that trust. And if we don't have these community banks, if everything is a Wells Fargo or whatever the equivalent is in Australia, there's never going to be those relationships. You're always just going to be a number. And then it's just going to go to risk management where they're just going to calculate some things and check some boxes. And you either get the loan or you don't based on these boxes instead of getting a loan based on a handshake and going to dinner with that person, looking them in the eye and saying, hey, is this guy or gal someone that I want to take a risk on, yes or no, based on human interaction?
Yeah, well, I agree absolutely. And, you know, I survey SMEs all the time here in Australia. Half of the SMEs say to me they cannot get the support and finance and funding they need, right? Half of them, right? So basically, there is a throttle on the momentum in the small and medium enterprise sector in Australia that is actually credit-led. In fact, I made a submission to Parliament quite recently saying there has to be a different funding model to enable small businesses to do what they want to do, because the banking system doesn't support them. And it's for that reason that you said, because the bank wants cookie cutters, right? You know, the bank wants to be able to say, tick, 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 tick. Yep, it's a mortgage. Yep, fine, yeah, go. Right?
Exactly.
And they can automate that, and they can reduce the human interaction through the process, and basically just turn it into an automated process. And you apply online and you get the money and nobody even thinks about it. Right. That's the future of banking that they want, because it's efficient and, you know, the capital ratios, et cetera, control that mode of operation. But I would argue that the true future of banking is exactly what you're saying, where people actually have interactions and people get to know, what's actually driving that particular business. There are lots of businesses in Australia with great ideas that just cannot get the funding. And I think this is probably one of the most critical discussions to have, because, you know, there are businesses today that could become massive businesses tomorrow, and yet they never get off the ground because the systems don't allow them to get off the ground. And the way that the banking system works in Australia is it's becoming more and more and more, you know, a juggernaut, or a small series of juggernauts, actually all competing for the same business, all competing for the, and if you're above a certain scale, you might be able to get some loans. But if you're a smaller business and you've got something, you know, that actually needs some help, and often you do, you know, you need some finance to be able to get through, particularly now. Yeah, that there's a huge gap. And unfortunately, more and more of even the small players are getting consolidated and aggregated into larger players. And as they do that, they lose that community connection. And I think it's a real, real problem.
Yeah, and the small and mid-sized enterprises are the ones that could grow and diversify the economies to where you weren't so dependent upon that one pillar of real estate. You know, I'll tell one more kind of quick story that I think illustrates this well. As you know, I retired in 2012. Before then, I've hired and worked with literally thousands of employees over the span of being an entrepreneur. And I got to the point where toward the end of my career, I'd have an employer, a potential employee, come in for a job opening, and they'd give their resume, and it was nice and pretty on this, you know, thick paper, and the font was nice, and it was perfectly outlined, and they went to this great school and all these other things. And honestly, Mark, I wouldn't literally throw it in the trash, but I didn't want to be disrespectful, but I wouldn't even look at it. Honestly, I would not even look at it. I don't even care what's on your resume, because anyone can put anything on a resume that they want to. I want to have that person sit right in front of me at my desk, and the only thing I want to do is ask them questions. And it's, to be honest with you, the questions themselves really aren't important. I just want to open up a dialogue so I can see the person talk, because when they talk, the eye contact, you know, how they're responding, you know, where they're looking, just how confident they are, they can express their opinion. It tells me all the things I need to know as to whether or not I want to work with that person. And I don't get that from a piece of paper, right? I'll never get that from a piece of paper. And it goes back to what you're saying with the banks. They're making these decisions based on a resume, using that metaphor, instead of just that face-to-face contact and reading people, reading the entrepreneur, hearing their passion that they have for their project and how much, you know, ambition they have and how much they're willing to sacrifice in their personal lives to make this happen. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, it's about passion, isn't it? And, you know, very interestingly, I was contacted the other day by somebody very senior in a very well-known, I won't mention the name, company in Australia, who actually is in the technology space. And they said they've been watching what I do on my channel, and they want to work with me because I get the innovation thing. I get the need to be able to shift the conversation to a different place, and they want to basically be involved in that conversation. So I'm going to get the CEO to come on down the track, and we're going to actually talk about what it's like to try and actually drive a business forward, and you know how hard it is in Australia, because that they see and I see that we are missing the opportunity that there is if only we could shift the thinking, right? And that's, again, partly a political thing, it's partly a structural thing, it's partly a financing thing. But actually, this is so critical for the future of Australia, because if we don't have those innovators creating those businesses and making them into bigger businesses that actually can create more value, all you're doing is chasing the same dollar around the system. And unfortunately, you know, eventually that dollar goes into aged care or healthcare or whatever else, but it's just the same dollar. We need more dollars going around the system.
Yeah, that's right. How do you see regulation playing into that?
Well, I think in Australia, we have huge amounts of regulation. We have red tape, you know, wrapped in red tape, frankly.
Yeah. I've actually done business in Australia. I think I mentioned I lived there, but when I was there, I did business. It's incredibly difficult.
Yeah. And, you know, there is all this lip service about cutting red tape. But in fact, every time you look, you know, if I'm a small business myself, right? So I have to do returns every quarter, and I have to provide this information and that information. And, you know, they do not make it easy, frankly, to run a business, right? And it's all down about tax integrity, you know, and all those sorts of things. You know, there's always the reasons why it's the way it is. But no, there is a real problem here in terms of the cultural norms that are being imposed on particularly small businesses, right? Because those barriers really get in the way. And, you know, every time you go to try to do something, you trip over more rules and regulations. I come from the UK, right? And I came out, and in the UK, I was always somebody who said, well, you know, you know, you want a few rules, but you don't want too many rules. I came to Australia, and it was like, everything's got rules, right? Yeah. You know, thou shalt, you can't do, you know, you'll be fined if you. I mean, it's an amazingly controlled environment here. And yet people who have lived in Australia all their lives just think, well, it's not the way it always is. No, it doesn't have to be like this, right? So I think there's an opportunity there to really think hard about where you need, you know, regulation and support, and where you can actually allow the market to, you know, expand and develop without too many controls. But at the moment, the hurdles in front of people to be able to actually do anything are just, you know, horrible.
Yeah, just to put this into context, a real life story. I was trying to do something in a local mall when I was there. I can't remember if it was in Sydney or where. It might have been in Perth. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But all I was trying to do is we'd rented a space in the mall, just kind of in the middle courtyard area. And we were just putting up a table, and we were going to do an autograph signing with a celebrity, right? So we just put up stanchions, and, you know, maybe 10, 20 people get in line for their autograph. They get their picture taken, whatever. And it's just a table. It's all it is. It's just a table and a chair. That's it. And it took me days dealing with the mall, and I had to have this security, and I had to have this, and I had to have these big, huge lights and these trash cans and everything. I'm like, guys, it's just a table, and we might have 10, 15 people in line at any given time. It's only going to last 2 hours. And I was just completely blown away. But that gives the viewer a real life story of how insane it gets there. And you can imagine a small business that didn't have the resources, they can't deal with stuff like that. And what that does is just consolidate everything to these big players that have the economy of scale. So you combine that with the lack of funding, and it just makes it impossible for the little guy.
No, well, I agree. And look, I think I've got this view, and, you know, people will accuse me of being a bit biased here, but I've got this view that the thing is that effectively people in Australia are being treated a bit like kids, right? They're not really allowed to be and achieve their potential, because essentially thou shalt, you know, you must, right? It's like there's this power structure that is just always bearing down, right? And you know, Australia is a great place, and it's got, you know, wonderful beaches and wonderful climate, and, you know, the people are actually great, but we are overborne by this sort of massive headache of stuff that just comes down from on high. And structurally, if we could release that momentum and allow ourselves to grow up and effectively, you know, achieve our potential, Australia could be amazing. And yet we seem to be hobbled all the time.
How is the COVID crisis there I mean, I haven't looked at the specific statistics. I see, obviously, the United States is, if you want to believe those stats, that's a completely separate video. But according to the stats, let's say from Johns Hopkins, the United States has the most cases right now. But how is it in Australia? And what do you think about a potential second wave and what it might do to the economy?
So we had 102 deaths so far, right? And we've had a few thousand cases. So, we're not quite as good as New Zealand. New Zealand actually just declared that they've got rid of it locally and they've released all of their, social distancing rules and everything else.
Oh, that's great.
In New Zealand. So New Zealand has actually been quite a good model of how to deal with it. Australia's not been quite so good, but we're actually pretty good. So we're releasing some of the rules and allowing the economy to slowly come back. There is a risk of a second wave. And in fact, there were big marches over the weekend, the Black Power thing, or Black Lives Matter, I should say. And there was a big debate between the people saying, hang on, social distancing is going to go out the window. That's going to lift the risk versus this is a really important issue. And we actually need to protest because the Aboriginals here have had a really bad time for a long, long time. Right. And ultimately, there was a court hearing in Sydney to try and stop it, which was overturned. So it actually went ahead. So there are examples where potentially you might see, a second wave. The trouble is, of course, it's delayed by 2 or 3 weeks. You'd have it takes some time to work through. So, but at the moment, it's pretty much under control. A lot of the cases in Australia were actually imported, right? So there was low levels of community transmission. And that was partly because the borders were probably shut a bit late. But more importantly, we had lots of foreign cruise ships coming here and dumping people and just allowing them to come back into the community immediately. They changed that very late. And there are inquiries about why that happened. But at the moment, the levels of community transmission are pretty low. So we're probably okay. There is a risk of obviously a wave two. And, if you look at South Korea, they've got a wave two there now at the moment. And I think Singapore the same. So, it's not over till it's over. But at the moment, the economy took a huge hit. The government threw lots of money at the system to try and support people through various mechanisms. And now they're talking about, well, how do we pull that back? And in fact, yesterday they announced that they'd actually take free childcare away, which is one element they put in place in the middle of July. So that's now creating another issue. But we've got a cliff in September. So effectively, there's a lot of programs that stop in September. And so the question is, economically, what's going to happen when the government stops effectively subsidizing a lot of people's salaries and when the banks stop the interest and principal repayment holidays? It could be a cliff, right? And so my view is the next sort of few months is going to be quite interesting to try and see how much of the economy comes back, what happens in the September environment. But the official position is we are in recession. That was actually admitted by the Treasurer last week. The next quarter will be a really bad quarter. And then, of course, it's what happens after that. But in terms of the numbers of deaths, very low. In terms of the community transmission, very low. So, some kudos to the politicians and to the health people here. They were very late, I think, in closing the borders. If they closed the borders earlier, we could have actually had an even better outcome. But we're in a lot better than many countries. But the economic impact is huge. And of course, because we're so trade exposed, it's not just what happened locally. Tourism isn't happening. So that's a big, international students aren't coming back. That's another big hit. And of course, whilst we can export some stuff, in fact, the export numbers were pretty good last month. And the iron ore price is now over $100 because Vale in Brazil is now off again because of what's happening over there with the COVID. The economy is, firing in areas, but a lot of other areas, hospitality, tourism, entertainments, they're all pretty much turned off at the moment. So, yeah, I think we're in deep doo-doo in terms of recession. And I have the view it's going to take 5 years to get out of this. And in the meantime, we'll have incurred huge amounts of debt.
Yeah. What do you think about September coming along and there being a lot of political pressure to continue with the payments and the mortgage holidays? that will potentially increase the debt even more long term?
I'm almost certain that they'll have to taper rather than actually turn off in September. Within the ruling party here, there are people towards the right who say we've done too much, we've actually lent too much, this debt is unsustainable, and we should be turning it off now, right? So that is a voice that's there. There's another voice that says, no, we actually, this is a once in a generation, once in a 100-year thing. We have to actually assume that we will need to support the economy. And, you know, the argument is with interest rates very, very low, and if you invest in the right things, you can actually create more momentum and growth, and that can actually then create more value down the track, so it's worth doing. I guess it's a la MMT, right? So that debate is going on. Unfortunately, it looks to me as though we are definitely on the same old story. In other words, debt is bad. We have to actually get the debt down as soon as we can. So there will be a lot of pressure in the, you know, particularly in, from I think some of the liberals to turn it off. Mm. And I'll be interested to see how that plays out. You know, obviously the Labour Party is saying no, this needs to be continued. The debt's very high, probably higher than it's been for a generation. At the point, by the way, because previously they were declaring victory on debt, so they were basically going to break even before COVID hit. So they've now got this massive amount of debt.
As far as the budget deficit, they're at a break
correct.
Even.
Correct. Yeah.
Wow, balanced budget. That's pretty incredible. On what's a cash the GDP there?
It's about 38, something like 36, 38, I think.
Yeah. Debt to GDP is 38%.
Yeah.
Wow, that's actually
it's low.
Very good compared to the United States.
So we have headroom, right, compared with many other countries. And, you know, I think the thought is it could go up to 40, maybe up towards 50 as we go through this cycle. But, of course, the point there is interest rates are really, really low. So the debt burden, if rates stay low, will be sustainable. But obviously you have to pay the capital back eventually. And again, a lot of people say, well, you know, you don't have to think of the public debt the same way as a household balance sheet, you know, because essentially you can do things to keep it going for a long longer, right? And look at other countries around the world, you know, 100% of GDP. Look at Japan with way more, right? You know, and it's just part of the furniture. So there's an interesting debate there. But the fact is that if you talk to real households, as I do in my surveys, we've got more households today in financial pressure than ever, right? We've got a lot of cash flow issues. We've got a lot of people totally reliant on the government support mechanisms that are in place, and their jobs are going, or their jobs are not coming back the way they were. There's a lot of pressure and a lot of talk about wage compression, right? So there's no wage growth. We haven't had any real wage growth since about 2012, I think.
I was going to actually ask you that. Yeah, so you guys have been flat on the real wage growth since 2012,
correct.
But while housing
correct.
Prices have gone straight up, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why the debt ratios are, you know, way off the scale, right? Because basically, and you know, I think I may have told you the analogy before of the frog in the hot water, right? So you're in there, the water's quite cool, you turn the flame up and slowly the water gets hotter and hotter, and people don't notice, right? So people don't notice that actually they're paying more than they used to on their housing. And of course the argument is, well, no, but rates are really low, so basically, you know, the serviceability hasn't changed much, right? But actually the serviceability is different now, because the serviceability is much more on the capital rather than on the interest, which means that it's a bigger problem to get rid of, right? Because the fact is that capital you have to repay at some point, and in the neoliberal view of the world, debt has to be repaid.
All right, buddy, well, we're going on an hour here. I could keep going and going and going. I sure appreciate your time. For my viewers or listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Okay, so I have a YouTube channel called Walk the World, and that's where I put daily shows up on economics, politics, philosophy, and a few other things. And my blog is at digitalfinanceanalytics.com.
All right, Martin, I appreciate it, and I can't wait to do it again.
Good to talk to you. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com. Or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.